hear the conclusion of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7, beginning verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house. And yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall. I suppose that any homiletics professor worthy of his tenure would probably call down Jesus on the abrupt, negative, off-putting conclusion to his sermon. Everyone knows that the big illustration goes at the beginning, and you build to a crescendo, leaving your audience with a challenge, but also with the idea that they're glad they came and they would be thinking about coming back the next time. And yet, this crowd, we will discover, was absolutely dazzled by the words that Jesus spoke that day. They had heard plenty of blather from their religious leaders down through the years about what Rabbi Hillel or Rabbi Shammai had to say about a particular passage of Holy Scripture. But this Jesus taught with authority and power, unlike the scribes and the Pharisees. Let's see what we can learn from this remarkable story. It's a parable of two builders, or more accurately, a parable of two foundations. One of Jesus' favorite ways of conveying deep truth is through parables. On Sunday nights, we are studying the parables of Jesus. And a parable is a true-to-life story that teaches a profound spiritual truth using a concise and generally a common, easily understood word picture or series of word pictures. A parable is a story designed to drive home a significant lesson. There are approximately 70 parables of one variety or another, or parabolic statements at least, in the Gospels. A five-year-old in children's church may not be able to expound the finer points of the Sermon on the Mount, but I guarantee you, they can tell you what happens to the man who does not build his house upon the rock. If children can understand the main point of the sermon, maybe there's hope for us as well. So, parables are generally delivered in stark, matter-of-fact, black-and-white terms. There's no middle ground. There's no box to check that says somewhat agree or somewhat disagree. There is absolutely no danger of coming down with a mild case of kingdom living. Either you got it or you don't. Jesus declares there are two and only two categories of people. Every person who hears his sermon must identify with one or the other. There's the wise man. He hears, verse 24 says, these words of mine, and he acts upon them. And there's everybody else. That's the foolish man. Verse 26, he hears these words of mine and does not act upon them. So if you're not quite willing to call yourself in the category of the wise man, understand that the only place left for you is under the category of the foolish man, and you don't want that. So what is this action called for? And shouldn't Jesus be talking about believing rather than doing? He hears the word and he does. What's that all about? We generally don't like to talk about works because works sounds like works salvation, and that's not what he's got in mind. But we'll have to take a look. Understand, too, that He's not talking about religious people over here and rank pagans over there. He's talking about people who hear his words and act on them versus people who don't. And then there are two houses being built. Each house represents a life. And in the product of everything you do, there is this house. During our time on earth, we are in the process, the text suggests, of building a house. How we spend our time, how much we serve others, how diligently we work when we are on the clock, our devotion to our family, our involvement in our community, our opportunity to share the message of Christ with other people, everything goes into building this house. So how's yours look? How's it coming along? Pretty nice. Not great, but livable. A work in progress. Impressive. Small, but cozy. As real estate people would call it, adorable or cute. Quaint, affordable, perfect for downsizing. They know how to say it. Is your house sort of rambling and disorganized? Many years ago, Peggy and I were looking at houses to buy, and we found a house in a really, really outrageously nice neighborhood for a really small price by comparison to everything around it. And so we were interested, and we looked at it. And came away with the idea that the guy who built that house must have awakened every day and thought, I think I'll add a room today. And it was rambling, but there was a lot of square footage, and it looked like it might be just the place for us. At the heart of this parable, there are two foundations. So you got two men, two houses, two foundations. And you are one of these two men in this parable, in this story. Your life is represented by one of those two houses. And Jesus preached the entire Sermon on the Mount to tell you it all comes down to one of two foundations. You know when the worst stadium disaster of all human history took place? I did not know until this week. I was looking for a really good disaster for my illustration, and I found it. It happened. No, it happened about a year before Jesus preached this sermon. The worst stadium disaster in all human history took place about 5 miles north of the city of Rome. Tiberius had banned the gladiatorial games, but he later rescinded the ban, and an entrepreneur named Attilius decided to build a massive amphitheater. It would seat 50,000 people. Attilius cut a few corners along the way. It might call to mind a few building projects in our fair city from days gone by, but we won't go there. The superstructure was made of wood, probably not the best choice, but the entire thing, turns out, was cheaply built. And once the gladiatorial games were back, he had to rush construction to finish it on deadline. The place was filled to capacity on opening day. Throngs of bloodthirsty people who had been denied the opportunity to go to these horrid, evil games where these slaves were made to battle against each other, and only those who survived were able to move on. They converged on the place. And the whole place collapsed upon itself. 50,000 people were there. 20,000 people died in a few moments. And many, many more were injured. The real reason has pretty well been established by people coming along and studying behind this thing, and that it was that Attilius did not go down to bedrock. He did not have a proper foundation that could withstand all of the weight of the superstructure filled with 50,000 people. An inferior foundation that could not sustain the building. And I have to wonder, as Jesus is preaching this message, by then certainly the stories would have circulated throughout the empire. By then certainly the story would have come to Galilee. And I don't have any way of knowing. I didn't come across this story in any other place where it related it to the Sermon on the Mount, but you just got to wonder, was this on people's minds when Jesus talked about these houses and these foundations? The choice that every person listening to Jesus on that hillside over the Sea of Galilee, the choice every one of us today is called to make is this. You can build your house, you can build your life upon a rock. When Peggy and I were in Yemen a decade or more ago, we visited the House on the Rock. And it is this amazing, very Yemeni house that sits on this outcropping, a solid rock thing, and is a place that you would want to be if you were under attack. A house that has stood for centuries and hopefully is still standing in the midst of all of the war that poor country has sustained at the hands of foreign powers, using them for a battlefield today. You can build your house upon the rock, or you can build it any place else. You can go down to bedrock, or you can just kind of build it on the shifting sands around you. I can't help but wonder, as I think about the pictures going through people's minds of how many disasters down through history have taken place because people didn't follow the code. I remember a hurricane that hit Florida many years ago, and there was a picture, and in the middle of all of this subdivision that had been totally wiped out, there was one house standing, and you think, how could that happen? And they interviewed the man, and he explained that he followed the code. He did everything exactly the way they told him to do it, or a little bit better, and his house withstood. The scribes and the Pharisees and the phony priests had been building grand-looking edifices over the sinkholes of their own self-righteousness. Jesus said, that ain't going to work. That will not sustain a coming storm, and that storm is coming. The only structure that will stand the test of time is built by people who hear the words of the Sermon on the Mount and act upon them. Wow. Maybe you should have been listening more carefully as we went through the Sermon on the Mount. We're finishing today, so you'll have to go back and reread them. You can see them. You can find them online. Or you could just pick up your Bible and read it over and over again. You want to build your house so that it stands the test of time. Jesus will always be either a cornerstone or a stumbling stone. Never part of one and part of the other. And the entire sermon comes down to this. Just as he has said that only those who enter the narrow gate will be on the road to his kingdom, just so only those who build on the solid rock of his righteousness will find their house standing at the end. That your life, that your time on this earth, that your opportunities while you're here, for them to have any kind of meaning 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years from now, You have to be building upon upon the rock of Christ's righteousness. He's not talking about obtaining salvation. You can be the nicest person in the world and spend your time helping everyone and doing wonderful things, and you can fast twice a week, and you can pray eloquently when called upon in an assembly of people. You can give to the poor, but verse 25 warns of a coming storm that will reveal your foundation. Built upon the bedrock of Christ's righteousness or upon the sand of human effort. Now, some would suppose that the storms Jesus is talking about are the storms of misunderstanding and disappointment, of the mistreatment that we suffer in life, of cynicism and doubt, of suffering and persecution, that these are the storms of life that we all face, and that in order to stand through these storms, we need to have a good foundation in Christ. And I won't argue that that's true, but that's not really what he's talking about. He's not talking about the storms that come in our lives on a regular basis. He's talking about the storm, the final storm, the judgment that he is declaring is coming. When persecution comes, it's no longer fashionable to be identified as a Christian. Then certainly some quietly lower the flag and head off into the shadows. When life gets tough, there are those who drop away from the family of faith, suggesting that their foundation was faulty all along. But Jesus is saying that even in those sandcastle lives, if they should survive the slings and arrows of outrageous bad fortune, the tsunami of God's judgment will tell the final tale. The terrible day of God's wrath poured out on unrighteousness will declare who has the right foundation and who acted upon the words that Jesus spoke in this message and who built upon that foundation that is Christ himself. If that sounds a little fire and brimstone-y to you, this is Jesus. You can take it up with him. It's really not my words. He said it. If you got the right Bible, it's even in red. So there it is. Or the wrong Bible, it depends on how you look at it. There is urgency, there is finality, there is eternal judgment bound up in these closing words. Not the kind of message that is looked upon as seeker-friendly in our day. And Jesus not only speaks about it, he brings the whole sermon to a close with those words. I got to admit, I would be tempted to pad it at the end with some, but we're not talking about you people. We're talking about those people or something else, but Jesus doesn't do that. He probably knows better than I do. What could possibly go wrong? Building on a bad foundation. I don't believe Attilius sat down one day and decided to build a huge amphitheater that would not make it through its first full use. I don't think he sat at a drafting table and thought, you know, how can I build this thing so that it will have a rotten foundation and it will collapse in on itself and pour out upon people all in the surrounding area to take 20,000 plus lives. But going down to bedrock is cumbersome, and it's labor-intensive, and it's expensive, and it's time-consuming, and he just didn't have the time or the inclination to build according to code, which I don't think they had back then anyway. Building on sand that's pliable and smooth is a whole lot easier. Quicker, cheaper, and I suppose that Attilius thought himself clever And he was busy counting the money he would receive from 50,000 people, a shot coming to this massive amphitheater to witness the games. And what a stroke of luck that he should get this thing built just as the emperor decides that, you know, I really miss a good gladiatorial fight, watching people get slaughtered in front of us. We need to have more of that in our society. What could go wrong? Kingdom living is demanding. Walking with God requires discipline. Most of us kind of have a built-in aversion to discipline and hard work. Jesus says you got to hear these words of mine and you got to apply these words of mine. If you're going to build on the foundation that is the only one that stands the test of time. And Jesus says it's worth it. It's worth it. This greatest of sermons ends right here in the midst of the crashing sounds of destruction. Beautiful looking houses collapsing into eternal ruin. I'm guessing that the Galilean slope that he sat upon as he was teaching, that all down to the Sea of Galilee, you could hear a jaw drop as he stopped speaking with those final words. A silence, I suppose, settled over the gathered masses of people. The response to the sermon is in verses 28 and 29. When Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. There are a series of structural markers through the Gospel of Matthew that signal changes in direction of the narrative, turning points in the story. And verse 28 is is one of those. From this moment on, the religious leaders who were intent on using their self-righteous ways to control people and to attempt winning God's approval would always find themselves at odds with Jesus. And the response from the crowd that day was one of profound, dumbfounded amazement. Jesus has been speaking and speaking. I think he went past noon. We may get out early today. I don't know. But Jesus must have gone way past noon and nobody had noticed the clock. They were listening. They were hanging on every word. And when he got to the end and just stopped in the midst of the storm of judgment, it was astounding to them. A buzz of gobsmacked wonder settled upon them. Literally, it says, they were struck out of themselves. That's what the Greek language says. They were struck out of themselves. In our day, we might say it just totally blew their mind. After listening spellbound to Jesus' sermon, they were struck by the fact that Jesus taught like nobody else had ever taught. These religious leaders were engaged in serious conversations about, is it lawful to eat an egg that was laid on the Sabbath? Because the chicken did work to lay that egg. There were important questions to be asked, according to these people. And they would bring one against the other, and they would say, well, this one says this, but this one says that, and I hang my hat with the one over here who says something entirely different. And that's how they would go through. They had books and commentaries and commentaries on their commentaries on their commentaries, and then the word of the current rabbi to go to just kind of evaluate what do we do? How do we live according to the law that was given to Moses on Mount Sinai? because it doesn't seem to work out well. It always seems to leave us with this sense of not enough. And Jesus comes along and he says, guys, it's not enough. It's no good. Your righteousness has got to be better than the Pharisees, and those guys are experts. Your righteousness has to excel that. In fact, it has to be perfect righteousness. That's what the law was really all about. They're used to weaseling answers to these hard questions, hedged by invoking the names of famous teachers who held all these different points of view. Jesus does not hedge his bets. He doesn't soften the message to make it more marketable. He doesn't go all risk aversion as he thinks, you know, I got to land this thing somewhere here, and I want these people to keep listening to me, so I need to brighten up the message at the end just a bit. He doesn't sound seeker-friendly at all. He just sets out the truth. Just two kinds of people, believers and make-believers. Just two kinds of houses, one built on the rock of Christ's righteousness, the other built on whatever you want. And just two kinds of outcomes. A life that stands the test of time, that has some stuff in it that is of eternal significance, and one that doesn't. A.T. Robertson says, we have specimens of three discourses preserved in the Mishnah and the Gemara. That's the commentary on the Old Testament scriptures and the commentary on the commentary of the scriptures. He goes on, the driest, the dullest collection of disjointed comments upon every conceivable problem in the history of mankind. And this is A.T. Robertson, who writes some pretty heavy stuff that comes in hardbound books that are sitting on the shelf getting dusty most of the time. It's not easy reading. He was a bit of a nerd scholar himself, and he's calling these guys the dullest collection of disjointed comments upon every conceivable problem in the history of mankind. Those guys majored on minors. They strained at gnats. They spoke at insufferable lengths about such important matters as the appropriate length of the fringe on the garment of the high priest. How long should that fringe really be? And they would go round and round in debate on such topics. But the message that Jesus has is spoken with authority and truth, and his message is real, and it's fresh, and it's powerful, and it's life-changing. And the people who had sat in darkness for 400 years, not hearing anything from God, are suddenly hearing God speaking clearly to them.